We are calling the Senate State Affairs Committee to order. It is 3:34 p.m. on Thursday, March 2nd. Let the record show that we have a quorum to do business. President of Senator Giesel, Senator Wilson, Senator Egan, Senator Cogkill, and myself, Senator Dunleavy. Purpose of our meeting today is to hear three bills, SB 26, Permanent Fund Deposits, Dividend Earnings, Rules by Request, through the Rules Committee by request of the Governor, SJR 2, Constitutional Amendment Appropriation Limit by the State Affairs Committee, and SB 48, Insurance for Dependents of the Deceased Fire Police, prime sponsor Senator Cogkill. We're first going to turn to SB 26, Permanent Fund Deposits, Dividend Earnings. Testimony was taken on this bill, on this Senate Bill 26, on February 21st. We will now close public testimony on this bill. What is the will of the committee regarding SB 26?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill number 26, version 30GS1690/alpha from this committee to the next with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you. Are there any objections?
I object.
Senator Wilson, do you wish to speak to your objection?
Yes, Mr. Chair. You know, throughout the time listening to some of the economists that have come through our committees, other presentations, we talk about not wanting to do any harm to the local economy. But through those presentations, we've seen that the one thing that has most devastating effect is the reduction of a permanent fund dividend. Thus, hence that sort of medical philosophy, do no harm or do less harm to the economy, I cannot, with good conscience, pass this bill.
Okay, and do you maintain your objection?
Yes.
Okay, with that, can we do a roll call vote on SB 26?
Senator Wilson. Point of order. Mr. Chairman, could you articulate clearly what we're voting on?
Yeah.
What
yes.
the measure, what
sure.
the statement is we're voting on?
Sure. We are voting on moving SB 26 out of committee. There was an objection made by Senator Wilson. His objection is maintained, so we are now doing a voice vote to move SB 26 out of committee.
So clarification, a yes vote means to move the bill,
yes.
A no vote means not to.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Eden?
Yeah. So I can still vote no rec?
Yeah, of course.
Yes. Okay.
Are we ready?
Senator Wilson?
No.
Yes.
Senator Egan?
Yes.
Senator Kaga?
Yes.
Senator Dunleavy?
No.
Three yeas, two nays.
So the motion to move the bill passes. It will go on to the next committee referral. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the documents. We are back in session. This is, again, the Senate State Affairs Committee, and we are now moving on to our next item, which is SJR 2. SJR 2 is a constitutional appropriation limit. We are going to have invited testimony for SJR 2, and today online we'll have Penn Piffner, chairman of the Tabor Committee. Just a little background on Mr. Piffner. He's out of Colorado, but Mr. Piffner is a former state representative, having served 8 years in the legislature. His major bills included the enhanced sentences for dangerous pedophiles in the state's first full restitution policy. He authored the repeal of the capital gains tax revision to create performance-based pay for state employees and wrote major deregulation bill of the decade. He has taught college economics part-time for 13 years. He has earned a master's degree in finance from the University of Colorado. He currently serves as the chairman of the Tabor Committee and its sister organization, the Tabor Foundation. So with that, Mr. Piffner, are you online?
I am online, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you for testifying. If you could state your name for the record and just who you want to put on the record you're affiliated with and begin your testimony, that would be great, and then we'll entertain questions when you're finished.
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, my name is Penn Piffner, and I'm calling from Lakewood, Colorado, which is a western suburb of Denver, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Tabor Committee as its chairman. I applaud the sponsor's idea and urge the committee's support of SJR 2. You've been very familiar, and I saw the PowerPoint that you've put together when you introduced this bill, so you're familiar with the tax and expenditure limitation terminology. And as you think about how this is going to go through the system and what pushback you might get from people who want to see bigger and bigger government without restriction, I think the first thing you need to do is recognize that this is a spending limitation and therefore not some sort of repeat of the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights that we have here in Colorado. There, within this measure that you have, you do not, you are state only, where Tabor has a restriction on every level of government. You have no restriction of debt in your measure. You have 14 exceptions. Your measure is silent on the rebate of taxes that are collected above the cap, and there are no election provisions. So the Colorado Taxpayers' Bill of Rights was more ambitious, has a larger reach. But for all of that, what you're doing in resetting a spending cap makes a great deal of sense, because there's not much point in having a cap that is ineffective, as your research has shown. I've been asked to make a few comments about how the positive experiences we've had in Colorado would mirror the results you'll have from an effective appropriations cap. The overarching concept is to strike that healthy balance between family budgets and public goods. And really what this does is it focuses both the citizens and the elected officials on asking the right question. Too often people just will come to the legislature and say, well, I need this, or I need that, or I want this. And it's too easy to say, yes, I'm glad to hear what you want, let me get it for you. But by having a good spending limitation, what you're forced to ask is, what do you want more? That is, set priorities within a given budget, not just state some wild dreams and then try to fund it. So everyone has to live within a budget. And the value of that then is extended to government with measures, with tax and expenditure limitations such as SJR 2. And that's smart and that's fair. We have seen a very successful economy here in Colorado. We did not have a successful economy before 1992, and I'm not suggesting that you've got causation there as much as recognizing that some of the opposition to the Taxpayers' Bill of Rights was that it would damage our economy, and instead we have a roaring economy. We also have program stability. That is, there's a natural inclination for government to grow too fast in good times and to overpromise and to set up a base that's far too high. So that when fiscal challenges come, and they always come, recessions and the like, then we have seen our fiscal crisis to be limited, especially when compared to states such as California and Illinois, which have just grown their budgets immensely and then have to adjust whenever those challenges come up. You will hear, and may have already experienced, some pushback from people who would rather not have governments limited. And so I thought to anticipate some of those questions, some of those concerns, and tell you what our experience has been. You will hear from time to time that somehow Tabor either will or has eviscerated the state budget here in Colorado. When I was the fiscal policy director at a local think tank, I directed a study that used the non-political tax foundation information and found that Colorado, on a state and local per capita basis, ranked 26th in the nation. So we're right in the middle. That's hardly anybody's idea of damaging the budget here. Another challenge that you'll be given is that the Taxpayers' Bill of Rights somehow has damaged the spending for K through 12. And people who will make that allegation look to a national average of per pupil spending. Yet when you ask a more fair and reasonable question, which is, how does Colorado compare with its neighbors? So you take out the outliers, that is, states with small populations, rural populations, that have a different situation than we do. You also remove the immensely expensive school district spending in such failing places as Chicago and Washington, D.C. and New York. So when you look around the mountain and plain states and ask that same question, how does Colorado fund K through 12 spending? We compare very favorably. So we're ahead of some of our neighbors like Utah and Arizona, well ahead. Others were about even, Kansas, a little behind Nebraska. So we compare very favorably on that measure. The allegation that somehow this is going to damage the budget and keep government from growing has been given the lie by the fact that we have seen the total state budget of federal funds, cash funds, and general funds grow every year but one, two, and those were mere pauses. So there has been a strong support of the essentials for government here in Colorado with a Taxpayers' Bill of Rights in place. And then you may also find some of the same naysayers talking about how the state doesn't do this or the state doesn't do that or doesn't have enough money. Please remember and recognize that Colorado is one of four states in the nation that in which we spend more on a local basis than we do on a state basis. So it's very important when you think about Colorado's budgets to combine that state and local spending to get a total for how our governments act. As I read through SJR 2, I recognize that you've done some things that will, I think, help gain citizen support and allow citizens to understand this measure better. There really is no issue about rebasing to a lower level. With the formula that we have in place, the governments are given last year's budget, which comes from how much they took in and how much they spent under the formula, plus they get automatic increases of population, plus inflation, and that's a shorthand. We don't have time to go into the details of how that works. But for those times when, those recessionary times, when budgets don't fill the entire Tabor cap, then we start from that lower base. That has been a problem for a charge made by those who oppose these tax and expenditure limitations, and you simply avoid it altogether. I'll also note that a troubling aspect that we have dealt with through the courts has been the all-too-frequent use of the term fees when they really should be talking about taxes. And under our Taxpayers' Bill of Rights, there's required voter approval for new taxes. By not addressing, in your measure, whether that limitation is from a fee or a tax, you're going to avoid that sort of problem. I note that your measure is constitutional. And as NCSL has pointed out, former economics professor Barry Poulsen here in Colorado has written about extensively, with about 30 other states, or 30 states in the nation having some some expenditure limitation, the ones that are more successful are those that place them in the Constitution. And I understand from a brief discussion that Alaskans are cautious about amending their constitution, but certainly it's important that you're proceeding in this fashion. So altogether, I think you have a good measure. I think it's very intelligent to take the step that you're taking to make it an effective measure. And I'd be glad at this point to take any comments or questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pfiffner. Are there questions for members of the committee? I have a couple. I just want to make sure that we can contrast with what Colorado has done and what Alaska, or at least the State Affairs Committee, SJR2, is trying to accomplish. In Colorado, it's your Tabor is not just at the state level, but correct me if I'm wrong, it's for cities, counties, and school districts as well. In other words, that Tabor exists for all those political entities as well.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. The Taxpayers' Bill of Rights, as written, talks about districts, and that pertains even beyond what you've mentioned. We have somewhere higher than 3,400 special districts, mostly for roads and water and sewer and the like, but even into things like in the rural areas, library districts and cemetery districts. And all of those are found under the Taxpayers' Bill of Rights.
Thank you. And I just want to make note that SJR2 does not include municipalities, boroughs, et cetera. It just pertains to state spending. Next question I have is, which is I think is also is different from SJR2, but the Tabor, a revenue measure of any type, correct me if I'm wrong, a revenue measure of any type cannot be enacted unless there's a vote of the people?
That's an overstatement, Mr. Chairman, of the situation. A new tax, a sunsetting tax that's going to be renewed, an increase in the tax rate, all of those are on their face necessary to have voter approval, as is getting new debt, getting into new debt by a district. But modifications that do not result, fiscal policy modifications that do not result in an increase in revenues are exempt, and certain other things are exempt, such as funding the pension plan and items to deal with fees.
Okay.
So the, yeah.
Thank you.
I don't think we want to go into the detail, but that was part of the problem getting Tabor passed in 1990 and why we changed things and made it in 92 to exclude fees.
And at the local level as well, or the district level as well, the same revenue guidelines apply?
That's correct. The local districts have the ability to relax those restrictions, and many of them have. In fact, when you think about how this has involved the citizen, the local districts have had to go to the citizen and say, you know, we want to get into debt, or we want to raise tax because we need a new firehouse, or we need to build a new school. And those local measures have passed somewhere around, somewhere higher than 80%. I think the last I heard was 84.5%.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions at all for Mr. Piffle? Excuse me, from all the members of the committee? Seeing none, we want to thank you very much for your testimony, and we may look forward to having you come back again and testify in the future, but we do appreciate it.
It's been an honor, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we're going to go to Barry Paulson, Professor Paulson with the University of Colorado. If you could state your name for the record, who you're with, and begin your testimony, that'd be great.
Yes, I'm Barry Paulson. I'm an emeritus professor of economics from the University of Colorado in Boulder, and an advisor to the American Legislative Exchange Council.
Okay, if you can begin your testimony, please.
Yes, Senator Dunleavy asked me to talk about our experience with Tabor here in Colorado and experience with TELS in other states, and I'll try not to duplicate some of the comments that Penn Fifter made, but I'll talk a little bit about our experience and then make a few comments and suggestions regarding SJR2. Feel free to ask questions at any time. I ask you to please speak loudly into the speaker, into the microphone. I have a little bit of a trouble hearing from the speakerphone. Let me try to provide a little bit of the historical background of our experience with tax and spending limits in Colorado, and specifically with Tabor. Colorado was one of the first states to introduce a tax and spending limit back in the 1970s, and that turned out to be not a very effective limit, mainly because state legislators chose to exempt major parts of the budget from the limit, and as a result it didn't constrain spending in the 1980s, and in that decade, Colorado was a lot like California. Government spending was growing much more rapidly than the private economy, and that really set the stage for the constitutional limit enacted through an initiative in 1992, the Tabor Amendment. And Tabor's turned out to be one of the most effective tax and spending limits in the country, and because it has two different types of constraints on the state fiscal policy, it includes substantive constraints and procedural constraints. The substantive constraints basically limit the growth of spending by any jurisdiction, state, local, to the sum of inflation plus population growth. Any surplus revenue above that limit must be rebated to taxpayers. And Tabor also incorporates procedural constraints. As you've heard, it requires voter approval for any increase in taxes or tax base or any increase in debt. Tabor was not triggered until the late 1990s. And for several years in the late 1990s, it constrained the growth of state spending significantly, and this resulted in surplus revenue. A little over $3 billion in surplus revenue was rebated to Colorado taxpayers, and of course that constrained the growth of state spending below the rate of growth of state income. Most importantly, what Tabor really did was then set the stage for significant tax reductions at all levels of government. And in that period, the state reduced state income taxes, sales taxes, business personal property taxes. At the local level, property taxes were reduced significantly. And Colorado ended up with one of the best business tax climates in the country. And in the late 1990s, Colorado experienced the second highest rate of economic growth of any state in the country. Now, we ran into problems with Tabor in 2001. Our economy experienced a sharp recession with an 18% fall in revenue, and that then set the base against which the Tabor limit applied, and the outcome was what is referred to as the ratchet effect. In effect, the state was rebating surplus revenue to taxpayers even before we had fully recovered from the recession. And that then set the stage for several referendums in 2005. A referendum D asked the state, asked citizens in Colorado to approve an increase in debt. Citizens turned that down. Referendum C provided for a five-year timeout from the Tabor limit and also reset the base and the way in which the Tabor limit was calculated. So for 5 years, state revenue and spending increased more rapidly than, or it had the potential to increase more rapidly than the Tabor limit. And then in 2010, the Tabor limit again applied, and it was not triggered until this last year, at which point we again had our revenue and growing more rapidly than the Tabor limit, and this has again triggered tax rebates to taxpayers. So the Colorado economy has recovered well from this recession, and we are now growing more rapidly than most other states. And so I think that this tax climate, the very positive tax climate that's been created, has been a significant factor in the rapid recovery and economic growth of the state. Finally, let me comment about our experience with the procedural limits in Tabor. As you've heard, Tabor requires voter approval for increased taxes and tax base and increased debt at all levels of government. And so for two decades, Colorado citizens have been voting on hundreds of measures proposing increased taxes and increased debt. And as you've heard, these measures pass at a high rate at the local level. At the municipal level, they pass at about 50% of the time. But at the state level, taxpayers have been much more stringent. Only two minor tax increases have been approved over that period of time, and only one debt increase has been approved. So citizens have been able to constrain the growth of government significantly at all levels, and especially at the state level, because of both the procedural limits and the substantive limits in Tabor. I serve as an advisor to ALEC, and we drafted model legislation for tax and spending limits, and using our Tabor as the model, we made some refinements in our model legislation for a tax and spending limit. Mainly, the refinements included providing for an emergency fund and a capital fund. So you'll find in the model legislation that ALEC publishes for state TELs, the model provides that some surplus revenue be allocated into an emergency fund, a rainy day fund, and also providing for capital funds. And then additional surplus revenue is rebated or offset by tax cuts. Let me just briefly comment on the experience of other states, and more specifically Alaska. As you well know, in Alaska, many of these TELs that were introduced have not been very effective. And Alaska is like Florida. The fundamental problem with your TEL is that it's poorly designed, and as a result, the limit has increased more rapidly than state revenue, and so it's never constrained anything. And that's the same thing that's happened in Florida. So it's very important to design these TELs very carefully to achieve the desired result. And I concur with Penn Fiffner that SJR2 really appears to be a well-designed tax and spending limit that I think will be much more effective than the TEL you now have in place. Obviously, the imposing the limit on appropriations based on population growth and inflation will constrain the growth of state spending very effectively. And it will also, I think, provide a much more stable growth of spending over the business cycle. I think Alaska is like many energy states where there's a great deal of volatility in revenue, and that tends to result in great volatility in spending. So this is an important step in the right direction. And as Penn Fiffner pointed out, I think Alaska does have an important emergency fund and capital construction fund. So I think that this should accomplish what you're attempting to achieve. Let me add a few reservations in terms of what problems you might expect with SJR2. And Penn has already pointed out one problem, and that is that these tax and spending limits that limit taxes, tax revenue and tax expenditures, often put pressure on the state to fund programs with fees. You want to be very careful that that doesn't happen. And one way to address that is to have a very strict definition of user fees and distinguish user fees from taxes, so that you'd be sure to restrict only tax revenues and expenditures. There's likely to be another problem that also has been mentioned, and that is because SJR2 constrains spending only at the state level, you're likely to encounter pressure to shift programs and spending to the local level. And, of course, there are ways to prevent that or limit it. An important provision to consider there is to limit unfunded mandates by the state on local governments. We have a provision in Tabor that does impose that restriction, and you might consider incorporating that in SJR2. So my only final comment is that, as you have discussed previously, SJR2 does not have any procedural constraints on state fiscal policy or local fiscal policy. And I know that I was asked to comment on earlier tax and spending limit legislation in Alaska, and at that time I suggested that Alaska legislators consider requiring a procedural limits that would require voter approval for increased taxes and debt, and I was told that that really is a step too far. But I think that you should consider that either as part of SJR2 or as separate legislation. We found that these procedural limits in Colorado and other states as well have proven to be very important, in some cases more important than the substantive limits, such as your appropriations limit. What these procedural limits really do is allow citizens to determine how much government they want and how much they're willing to finance in terms of government spending. And we're not alone in this. If you look at other countries, citizens in Switzerland, for example, have been voting on increased taxes and debt for more than a century, and they've created one of the strongest fiscal systems in the world. So with those comments and suggestions, let me stop and ask if you have any questions or comments.
At this point, are there any questions or comments from members of the committee for Mr. Paulson? Mr. Paulson, this is Senator Dunleavy. I think Mr. Pfister touched upon the economic benefits, but if you could just take a minute to once again talk about how Tabor either, again, negatively impacted or positively impacted the private economy, the economic situation in Colorado.
Well, I often answer that question by contrasting Colorado and California. In the 1980s, Colorado and California were very similar, very rapidly growing government spending, growing much more rapidly than the state economy. And in fact, both states introduced tax and spending limits, very similar tax and spending limits. In California, they gutted their tax and spending limit by shifting a number of state programs, expenditures off budget that is not subject to their tax and spending limit. And of course, the outcome has been that California has experienced a continued rapid growth of government spending, much more rapidly growing than their state income. And they've ended up with high levels of deficits and debt, and their state economy over the last two decades has certainly underperformed compared to Colorado. So I think that our experience is that with an effective tax and spending limit in place, you can create a better business tax climate, and you can create the right incentives for business investment and job growth. And we continue to do that in Colorado. And this is certainly in part due to our success in constraining the growth of government.
Is the improved business climate, and we know obviously you're tying that to Tabor, but is it because the businesses look at Colorado and they say that, for example, if they come in, set up shop, invest millions, if not more, into Colorado, that they do not have to worry about a predatory tax regime that would then, for lack of a better expression, sink their hooks into that particular industry or business?
Exactly. And the Tax Foundation rates various states in terms of their tax business tax climate, and Colorado always rates among the top 10 states in terms of business tax climate. I served on our tax commission here in Colorado, and we held hearings around the state, and citizens testify before our hearing exactly how Tabor works, especially at the local level. For example, a little town of Lyman, Colorado, the farmers there testify that Tabor was very important for the community there. The community wanted to build a new jail and office building, and they wanted to increase the local sales taxes by a very significant margin. And, of course, under Tabor, they had to put this on the ballot. And the farmers there said when they put this on the ballot, they wanted a 5-6% sales tax increase, and they voted it down. They put it on the ballot again with a somewhat lower sales tax increase. They voted it down again. And finally, after 3 or 4 years, they put it on the ballot with a 1% sales tax increase, and they approved it. And what the farmers argued is that if they tried to raise sales taxes by that higher magnitude, if farmers would just go down the road and buy their equipment and feed and so forth at another community that did not impose that high sales tax. So I think what Tabor does is to basically allow citizens to decide how much taxes they're willing to pay, how much spending they're willing to incur, and basically how much government they want and are willing to pay for.
Thank you. And I've got one last question, and that is, can you talk to the public debt situation in Colorado and if how it relates at all to having the Tabor in place?
Well, unfortunately, Colorado, like virtually every other state, has found ways to circumvent the debt limits. Our original Constitution prohibited any debt at the state level. And, of course, every jurisdiction must have citizen approval to issue new debt. What both the state and local governments have done is to use non-general obligation debt, for example, certificates of participation, where you're designating a specific revenue stream to pay off the debt. And the courts have ruled that that type of debt is not a general obligation debt and therefore not subject to the Tabor limit or to the original constitutional limit. So we haven't necessarily constrained debt in the way that many might anticipate, but we certainly have limited debt compared to what would have occurred without Tabor. I think that the state, for example, has proposed five different measures over the last two decades to increase debt, and only one of those measures has passed. So Tabor has certainly been important. It hasn't been 100% successful in constraining debt.
So any questions from members of the committee? And so from your perspective, the Tabor in Colorado has restrained the growth of government and allowed more of the private citizens' money to stay in their pockets and has encouraged new business investment?
Exactly.
Mr. Paulson, thank you for your testimony. Again, we may call upon your expertise on this issue as we move forward in this on SJR2. We're going to move methodically and bring the state of Alaska along and be able to answer as many questions as possible. I just want to make a quick note that SJR2 is not modeled off of ALEC model legislation. SJR2 is really merely just a modification of the existing constitutional amendment that has been in place since 1982 in Alaska and reaffirmed in 1986. And it's interesting that Alaska got a jump on some other states on this issue when we were spending at a pretty steep incline in the 70s when we started to receive large sums of oil revenue. The problem, again, as we stated, is the incline was so great, the base was so, the projections were so great, and the components in the formulas were so liberal, and then there were holes kind of punched through it, that we would have to be spending approximately $10 billion unrestricted general fund today to hit that limit. So the idea is that with the new reality, as was mentioned, if we want to encourage investment from other industries or the current industries that we have, if we want to restrain the growth of government, the idea is to revisit, again, the constitutional amendment that the people of Alaska put into place to revise it to reflect the new realities that we have today. And so, again, we're going to continue. This is going to be a deep conversation so that we thoroughly understand this as we move forward. There's going to be no rushing this particular resolution, but we want to understand it as best as possible. We do have one other invited guest, and that is Matthew Mitchell with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Mr. Mitchell, are you online?
I am, yes.
Could you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please?
Yes, thank you so much. My name is Matthew Mitchell. I'm a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. So for several years now, my colleagues and I have been studying state fiscal policies and the institutions that govern them. We've consulted decades of peer-reviewed academic research, but we've also conducted our own analysis using comprehensive data sets and the best cutting-edge empirical techniques that are available. So I'm delighted to have the opportunity to share some of the lessons that we've learned with you today. So broadly, there are three lessons that I'd like to kind of concentrate on. The first is that rules matter, and that rules are often a better alternative to everyday politics, and I'll get into the definitions of what I mean by that in a minute. The second is that the details of these rules can make a very big difference, and small changes in the details can set states on very different fiscal paths. And then finally, there are a lot of alternative rules, and many of them work in ways that people might not expect, and often the most effective rules for budgeting are not the usual suspects, or not the ones that people typically think about. So let me just dive in. So on the rules matter. So as I'm sure I don't need to tell you all, as budgeters, that states often find themselves in fiscal trouble. You know, they frequently wrestle with unsustainable spending patterns or recurrent shortfalls that necessitate painful decisions, and often they're dealing with long-term obligations that can't be met or that are unsustainable. So there are a lot of short-term remedies, of course, when these problems arise. There's tax increases. You can skip your pension contributions. There are budget cuts that might not be the best budget cuts, or there's, you know, sort of tricks you can play, moving revenue from one year to the next or something like that. But the problem is, what we've seen is that states that pursue these short-term remedies often end up finding themselves right back into the same problem later, and that now there's, I think, a significant amount of research that suggests that more sustainable solutions to budget problems require institutional change. And so what I mean by institutional change is changes to the rules that shape the political, legislative, and budgeting process. So simply put, states with good institutions or good rules that shape this process are much more likely to make good budgetary decisions and find themselves less often in those problems. I understand you all are contemplating some institutional changes, so, you know, often I have to make the case to legislators that that's really a good place to start. I'm delighted to see that you're already essentially there. So lesson number two that I'd like to emphasize is that the details of these rules matter. And so I want to talk a little bit about my study of tax and expenditure limits, in which I looked at 30 years of data across the states to try to understand, get as rich of a data set as possible of the various varieties of tax and expenditure limits to see how they work and what characteristics make for a good tax and expenditure limit, or a TEL. Now, the good news I have to share with you is Alaska actually already has a number of the characteristics that make for an effective TEL. And by effective, I mean a TEL that seems to have a statistically significant effect on state spending as measured by real per capita spending and as controlling for other factors that might confound the estimate. So it's our best attempt at trying to get a clean estimate of what the effect of this is, of these rules are. So there are four characteristics that tend to make for effective TELs that Alaska already has. One, they target spending rather than revenue. Two, they limit budget growth via a formula that looks at the sum of inflation and population growth. A lot of states use a formula that looks at state income, and it turns out in high-income states, those tax and expenditure limits actually seem to be associated with more spending, not less spending. So the fact that you are focused, that your limit is focused on inflation plus population growth is already great. Three, they're codified in the Constitution, as is Alaska's. And finally, they require a supermajority or a public vote to be overridden. Believe it or not, a lot of states have tax and expenditure limits that can simply be overridden with a simple majority vote, so they aren't really limits in practice. But there are two characteristics that the most effective TELs have that Alaska does not currently have. The first is that they prohibit unfunded mandates to lower governments. About a dozen states do this. Essentially, it's a way to try to get around or prevent states from playing gimmicks by just adopting a policy that's in the excess of the limit, but shoving the obligation for implementing that policy down to the local levels of government. So that would be something I think that it might make sense for Alaska legislators to look at. Number two, states that immediately refund revenues, any revenue that's collected in excess of the limit to taxpayers. This is a characteristic of five states that have TELs, including the table in Alaska that Dr. Polson was just talking about. It seems to be that this has two nice features about it. One is it returns money to the people so that the state doesn't have a chance to spend it and ratchet up spending. But two, in returning money to the people, it gives the people some skin in the game and in terms of the tax and expenditure limit, and makes it something that they see the fruits of and the rewards of and so therefore they're less likely to go along with any efforts to undermine Mattel or to suspend it or something like that. And then finally, and I think this may actually be one of the most important characteristics for you all, because I think it's something you're considering, is, you know, you want to make sure that you use the appropriate base year. So you want to pick a year that is neither extraordinarily high in revenue, nor is it an extraordinarily tight year, a recession year, or something like that. And you want to make sure that it's based on a year in which you think spending was prudent, and you want to make sure that it's not just based on the last year, or else you invite what's called the ratchet effect. My understanding of the last Mattel is based on 1981, and it's really behooves you to make sure that that's the appropriate year. So then the final lesson that I want to share, and then I'm happy to, eager to hear your thoughts and answer any questions you might have, is I want to note that there are other tools. So tax and expenditure limits are often the first thing that state policymakers think of when they think, oh, we need to do something to rein in excessive spending or unsustainable spending. But they are, not only are they not the only, but they may not even be the most prudent or the most effective means of ensuring prudent fiscal policy. So I want to share a little bit of other research that I've looked at. So I recently performed a study in which we looked at dozens of peer-reviewed academic studies and 16 state-level institutions. And I want to share a little bit of what we found. So one thing is item reduction vetoes, but it turns out Alaska already looked into this. You already have one. So again, you're really, the institutions are working well. But item reduction vetoes are very effective in terms of states that have these tend to spend less than other states. But something that Alaska does not have is some states separate spending and taxing functions into two separate committees in each chamber. So they'll have, a taxing committee like a Ways and Means committee or a Finance committee, and then they'll have a separate committee called, a Budget committee. And I recently conducted a study with a professor from Duquesne University, Pavel Yakovlev, and we looked at the effect of this, controlling for all sorts of other factors that we thought might confound, or that the literature suggests confound the estimates. We found a really significant effect. So states that have separate taxing and spending committees spend between $300 and $450 less per person per year. To put that in perspective, for the average Alaskan household, which I understand is about 2.75 members, that's $825 to $1,237 per person per year less that these states are spending. So it can really make a big difference. Another thing we found is states that tend to have these separate taxing and spending committees also tend to spend more prudently. The areas where they were spending, the theory seems to be that when you have a combined taxing and spending committee, you're more likely to have legislators who are able to essentially spend on parochial pork barrel spending rather than genuine public good type spending, which is sort of the more efficient variety of spending. So there are other things like a strict balanced budget requirement that doesn't allow the state to transfer funds over to the next year. The states that have this spend about $184 less than states with weaker balanced budget requirements. And then the other thing I would point out, somewhat counterintuitively, some of these rules don't always work the way people think they will. Often biannual budgets are thought, well, maybe if we do a biannual budget, a budget once every 2 years, we'll have more time to think things through. This has actually been studied, and the research suggests that anything, states that have biannual budgets actually spend statistically significantly more than states that have annual budget cycles. So with an annual budget cycle, other things being equal, states tend to spend about $120 less per person per year relative to states that have biannual budget cycles. So that's probably a good spot for me to end. I just want to thank you again for the opportunity to share some of what we've learned with you all today.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. Mitchell? I have a quick question. Would you be able to mention a model state that has the separate taxing and expenditure committees that seems to work well?
Through the chair, yes, absolutely. I need to pull up my study here attached testimony, I have included a few papers, and one of them at the end of it has a map, and in that map you can see all the states that have combined and separate committees. Some states have separate committees in one chamber only, and other states have separate committees in all the chambers, or in both chambers. As it turns out, actually, most states do separate these functions. If you look on the map, it's on page 29 of that study. So states like Colorado and Arizona, Nevada, Utah, much of the Mountain West actually, all have separate taxing and spending committees.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Mitchell? If not, we want to thank you for your testimony today, and we would look forward to calling upon you in the future as we go through this process.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, we're going to take keep SJR 2 off of the side. As I said, we're going to go through this methodically. We're not going to rush this particular this bill, and we're going to take just a brief video so we can transition over to the next bill, which is SB 48. So just take a minute to transition over. Back in session. There's a committee substitute for consideration. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the work draft for the CS for Senate Bill 48, version Omega, before this committee.
Excuse me. I will object for discussion. We'll have our assistant, Krista McDonald, explain the technical changes in the CS for SB 48.
For the record, Krista McDonald, staff to Senator Dunleavy. Before you is a summary of changes, and I'm just going to walk through that so members know what's in the committee draft before you. But the first change is we changed the term police officer to peace officer throughout the bill in order to extend the benefits within this legislation to include probation and correctional officers. We consistently used the term major medical throughout the bill of this work draft. We have changed the annual deadline for the commissioner to determine the amount of money sufficient to pay premiums to December 15th. This bill also eliminates the gap in coverage by removing the requirement for the surviving dependent to submit an application to the commissioner. After the date of death of a peace officer or firefighter, the commissioner will have 30 days to determine continued eligibility. The bill requires annual determination of continued eligibility by the commissioner. The commissioner may require a surviving dependent to provide relevant information in order to make this determination. We clarified the term year-round by replacing it with a full-time position for which the state or municipality paid or expected to pay the employee for 12 months each year. We established that a surviving spouse becomes permanently ineligible for premium payments upon receiving 10 years of premium payments, becoming eligible to receive major medical insurance, or by reaching the age of 65, whichever of those comes first. We removed the word immediately to clarify that the municipality may elect to participate in the fund at any time. In the definitions section, we expanded upon the definition of firefighter to be an employee of the state or municipality whose primary duty is to perform fire suppression services. and replaced the definition of police officer with a new definition for peace officer.
That's it. So I will remove my objection to the adoption of the CS for SB 48. Is there any additional objection? Seeing none, SB 48 is adopted. Senator Coghill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this is a result of trying to find ways to bring the bill in consistent language. For example, in one place we had medical, another place we had major medical, and they do have different meanings. But based on at least the way I was thinking of it, the care should be as continuous as we get it and as consistent as we can get it. And this is probably a slimmed-down version of what a medical benefit would be. And I guess the difference that I should explain is one has, you know, the eye care and the dental care, I think, the medical, and the major medical is without that. So that's a policy call. I just wanted to bring it up to your attention. And I thought there should be a limitation. I don't know that the 10 years are perfect, but it was what was proposed in another bill. And I was trying to figure out a way to say that maybe it should be a diminishing benefit, but I thought, let's start there because that's consistent across the United States and in a previous bill. Then it, also, but I wanted to make sure that the youngsters didn't get caught up in the 10-year thing, so they're eligible till 26, or if they get a job that permanently gets them that insurance, it would drop. So that way they're taken care of until they can take care of themselves, basically. This allows for the best way I could think of making sure that we get an immediate care, because I think that was one of the problems I heard that was so disturbing, was that the month of the death of a trooper, the family finds out they're without health insurance. It's just absolutely amazing to me. And so this says the presumption is they get it until the commissioner says that there's an ineligibility problem, which I think is an easier determination for a commissioner to make. It expands to the corrections officers, mainly because they do transporting of dangerous criminals to and from jail. And though I don't know of any experience where a corrections officer or a probation officer has been killed violently, I wanted to make sure that they had that same, they deal with the same element, basically, a very dangerous element. This also allows the municipalities to figure out a way to do retroactivity, I think, to go back and pick up those who had previously had the unfortunate circumstances found in this bill. Let's see. It does require the commissioner to annually tell us what's in the fund and what they have done and what they expect. I mean, obviously, you can't tell what's going to happen, but at least I think the legislature needs to know what is going to happen with the fund. And the reason is because what we've done in this is we've made the fund so that it rolls over. It doesn't get swept back into the CBR, and that way it can grow. And at that point, the commissioner needs to kind of keep us abreast of what the circumstances of that fund are. It may make a difference on appropriation because it's really up to the legislature to appropriate. They may be able to get it up to a point and then not have to appropriate, you know. And I wouldn't break my heart if they never had to appropriate out of it, personally. But it still should be something that should be looked at. And the other thing is the determination of the eligibility, because we said if you remarry, you turn 65, or you hit that 10-year mark, there should be a way, and I was thinking more like when we go through our health care every year, we have to go through the open enrollment. To me, it's just a way of saying touching base with those who you're taking and paying the premiums for, basically. It's a way of making sure that there's a communication. And then the year-round, you know, we said permanent year-round employee. I think just make them a full-time employee, and I think it's appropriate. If they're in the danger work and they're full-time, but they're only 8-month employees or 5-month employees, I'll still think it's appropriate. So, but since the CS just kind of came into us today, in fact, I think most of the printing was still warm when we got to committee today. I would ask that that you look it over. This is things that I had thought through in talking to the Department of Law, things that I personally had tried to figure out how to do best. This is my best shot at it right now, and I'm open to discussion, but I wanted it to be in front of people so that they could see, look at the language, see if it actually works, doesn't work, or if there's some modification, and then get this thing moving along. It's a little different approach than that, than what the other body is doing, but I'm trying to stay independent and just think through, okay, if I was a mayor and I had to hire him, how would I deal with this thing? Because what we're doing is we're actually paying a premium for somebody to get an extended benefit, which I think is totally appropriate. And but it should have some limitations, and I'm trying to decide the best limitations we can do and still make sure that people are taken care of well. It's just a way to honor people, I think, the best way we can. So, you know, I'm open to discussion, but here it is. Those are the major changes.
Are there questions for members of the committee? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on page 3, Senator Coghill, the section 1, it's lines 6 through 9. I'm not sure I fully understand this. It says, on the date of the employee's death, the employee was employed by the state or a municipality that was elected to participate in a permanent full-time position for which the state or municipality paid or expected to pay the employee for 12 months each year. So are you saying that if they were in a seasonal position for only 4 months had an unfortunate loss of life, they would not...
I was under the...
Eligible? I just don't understand that section.
Well, I think I might have misspoke. We had actually talked about whether it should be full-time or permanent full-time.
Okay.
We added permanent. My apologies. And that would be a year-round... That would be as close as we get to a year-round employee. But if they're permanently employed and they're only that seasonal worker, my expectation is that that would be something that they'd have to look at. So... the answer is I'll have to look into it.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the addition and the peace off the change from police to peace officers, so we can include those other line of workers, the correctional and the probation officers that also have to put their lives on the line at times to deal with this as well. And I understand that the that was a huge change when I went to go visit some of the correctional facilities of the bill, that they felt that they were sort of left out, and I know that that organization really appreciates the addition to that. So thank you.
One of the reasons, what we're looking at here is people who are in the unpredictable, dangerous circumstances, and in as far as the police goes, it's been out and out assassination. I mean, that's as terrible as it can get. But it's also true that we're asking people to run into fires and run into danger, and I'm trying to keep it focused on those kinds of things. But these people fell clearly enough into it that they deal with that same element, and I thought that was appropriate. And then to make sure that the families at least are not left high and dry. I mean, to be fair, there are other benefits that, say, somebody from a fallen firefighter trooper get. On some of the wages, some of the insurance and all that. But the health care was a dramatic empty spot. It was just huge, dramatic. It was unacceptable. And, of course, I've had to learn this area. This was not my area of expertise. I had to come into it kind of being both pushed into it politically, but then I had a fallen trooper who was a constituent of mine whose wife was left languishing. It was just an amazing thing to me. And so I made the commitment that I would do whatever I could to find the best way to move forward. And this is outside of the PERS system. It's a fund, because in the PERS system, you can't actuarially make it statistically work in Alaska. The good news is we have too few people. The bad news is we have some people, and we have to make sure they're taken care of. So this is a fund that allows both municipalities and the state to add into the fund that can be drawn out of immediately to pay the premiums for the health care. So And I'm open to debate on the other points. And on my apologies, I probably did misspeak on the permanent full-time. I'll have to correct myself on that, Senator.
If there are no additional questions at this point, we do have a number of folks that wish to testify, and I would like to open up to public testimony. Are there any additional questions at this time for Senator Coghill? Okay. Seeing none, we're going to open the open it up for public testimony. Again, this is public testimony for SB 48, Insurance for Dependents of Deceased Fire and Police. We're going to go first to Kodiak. And Pat Holmes, are you online? And if so, can you state your name for the record and begin your testimony? And figure about 3 minutes, as we have several people wishing to testify as well.
Roger that. This is Pat.
Oops.
Got cut off.
Did you drop off? No, Mr. Holmes, we cannot hear you. You may want to check the mute on your phone.
Hello?
Yes, now we can hear you. Thank you. You can begin.
Wrong button. Yes, thank you very much. I wanted to thank John Coghill for sponsoring this bill. I remember his dad well, and my dad Pete, and Dick Randolph used to have some passionate discussions there in Fairbanks and Lenana. And also I recall Governor Bill Egan coming to my high school class in Fairbanks and talking to us. Both of those folks supported a very similar bill early in statehood, and that was for ADF&G field staff to that were peace officers to get into the peace officers retirement program. And in recent years, since budgets have been cut, they're no longer in that, and I would ask you folks to think about including them because they are peace officers. And I'll just cut to the chase. When that was cut out, I did testify to the committee at that time in favor of leaving it in, but in talking to Senator Fred Zaroff, who's retired, he said that their committee had asked the Department of Fish and Game to come up with a more restrictive definition of that, but I believe our commissioner at the time did not, because there were so many desk writers that were in that program that didn't go in the field. And the reason that program was established is because of the incredibly high death rate. And I think if you look at death rates for all the categories you're considering, and also probation and corrections, Fish and Game leads. I've kind of not quite current statistics, but it's somewhere close to 29 fatalities in the line of duty. And I spent 27 years with the Department of Fish and Game, and I lost a lot of good friends that flew into mountains. I've confronted poachers. I've confronted drunken fishermen with guns that threatened to shoot me. I had the window shot out of my truck here in Kodiak. Fish and Game field staff, ones that go to trooper school, experience all the same threats as troopers, city police, and they have a higher death rate. So I honestly would ask you to consider putting them back into this bill because the cost is not going to be that much, and it really means a lot to the widows and orphans. And anyway, I have a lot of others to say, but I do appreciate you folks bringing up this topic, and I hope that you can get the thing completed, but I would plead with you to consider ADF and G peace officers to be included in that program. Thank you so very much, and thanks for doing what you do down there. Things have changed the last lots in statehood, and it's good to see some families continuing in the game. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we're going to go to Fairbanks, and we're going to Ms. Brandy Johnson, are you online?
Yes, I am.
If you could state your name for the record, please, and begin your testimony. We'll extend the courtesy for a couple more minutes as well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. For the record, my name is Brandy Johnson. I am testifying in support of Senate Bill 48. On behalf of myself, my three daughters, my deceased husband, Scott Johnson, surviving families of past and future line-of-duty deaths, state troopers, as well as law enforcement officers in the state of Alaska. On May 1st, 2014, my husband, Scott Johnson, and Gabe Rich were murdered while in the performance of their job in Tana, Alaska. Scott's job was that of a sergeant with the Alaska State Troopers. He had worked as a state trooper for over 21 years with a total of over 23 years vested in the public employees retirement system. He could have retired with 20 years of service. However, Scott and I decided he should work another 5 years to gain the medical benefits for our family at the 25-year mark as a Tier 2 employee. It was while trying to obtain this promised benefit goal that Scott was ambushed and killed. Scott would have retired this past October with major medical benefits for himself and our family. I had asked the state troopers assisting me after Scott was killed if my family still had health insurance. I initially was told I was set for life by one lieutenant. However, that was not the case. I was later told that my family's benefits would expire at the end of the month. I was disappointed and angry. My choices were to pay $1,150 per month for the retirement major medical health care that he would have received in a year and a half at no cost as a retirement benefit, or $1,700 for full coverage COBRA. What is frustrating is that the person who shot my husband to death and his father who desecrated my husband's dead body while incarcerated have medical care available at no cost to them, as their families also have free health care. I felt Scott's last 3 years of service were all for nothing. Scott always took his responsibilities very seriously to protect the people of Alaska. I believed upon his death the state would also take responsibility to now take care of his family. Graciously, the state of Alaska has these past 2.5 years until the gap in law could be resolved. Our family has paid the price for this benefit. We have paid into the PERS retirement system. We have paid with the endless call-outs, whether it be canine, CERT, or one of the many other specialized emergency responses Scott was involved with. This is called to give of yourself for the sake of others. I am here today asking for your support of Senate Bill 48. This bill is more than what I've advocated the legislature for as a health benefit. This bill provides full coverage health insurance that takes care of young surviving families that need the well child checkup. The retirement health care plan was not a long-term solution. It was a band-aid, so to say, and a safety net in case of a major medical emergency. Senate Bill 48 will ensure that another surviving spouse does not have to experience what I have. They will have the assurance that their children will be taken care of if there was a health emergency. I would like to state my concern over one word in the legislation. The word is may on page 3, line 27. As a surviving spouse, I wouldn't want to hear may elect to participate. I have been left wondering about so much in regards to life. By changing one word to shall, would provide a great sense of security and comfort to past and future surviving spouses. Thank you for your time and your consideration of this important legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Senator Coghill?
I think that's a different version, and Brandy, there's a newer version, and so it's not on that exact line and page number, so you can go at a basis and take a look at this language so that any further testimony is in line with this. And we did take the major medical and make it uniform throughout the bill, just for your information. So that's going to be a little different than what you just testified on, and so that's input that we'll need to hear on.
Senator Giesel?
Mr. Chairman, on the new version, the language she's referring to is on page 4, line 6. Thank you.
So Ms. Johnson and others that are listening, this is a committee substitute, and we've just introduced and adopted the committee substitute today, and we're opening this up for public testimony. So as Senator Coghill said, when you get time, please go to basis and actually pull this up. But we're not going to move the bill today or act on the bill today. This is just for public testimony. So next we're going to go to Fairbanks again, and it's David Pruse. David, are you online? And if you can identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony, figure about 3 minutes.
Yes, thank you, Senator Dunleavy. My name is David Pruse. I'm here on behalf of the city of Fairbanks to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 48. I've not seen the committee substitute. The city of Fairbanks had a horrible tragedy, too, and we found out at the passing Officer Brandt that his insurance terminated immediately. So the city of Fairbanks took it upon itself to fund the remainder of 2016 and put into the budget to fund his family's insurance for 2017, and we will do so most likely in 2018. I have not read the substitute bill, and Senator Coghill, I wanted to meet with you this last Monday while you had a work session up here. However, I was in a city council meeting, so my concerns, though, are unfunded mandates to the municipalities, such as the city of Fairbanks, for carrying the cost of insurance to the family through 2038, possibly, for Officer Brandt. So I want to talk with you and review this and work with you privately so we can have a solution. The city of Fairbanks has also talked about having a specific insurance policy in our contracts with the police officers in case this happens again. They have their insurance premiums funded throughout the life of the spouses, you know, for up to the kid's age of 26. So this is a very important bill. I appreciate your work on it, and I thank you for my testimony.
Thank you. Senator Coghill?
Just a comment. Dave, you can look this up on BASIS, but this is not a mandate. This is an opt-in for municipalities, and it just allows you to also look back a little bit. So it's got some retroactive language in it. But it's a fund that the state can manage, but the municipalities have to fund, basically. So that's at least that's the way we got this set up right now.
Okay. Again, I'll review it, and I'll contact your office, okay?
Thank you. Next, we're going to go to Paula Johnson from Fairbanks. Ms. Johnson, if you're online, if you could state your name for the record, and please begin your testimony. We'll extend the extra minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Paula Johnson. Scott was my brother-in-law for almost 22 years until he was murdered in the line of duty in Tamanaw, Alaska on May 1st, 2014. Upon Scott's death, he was past his 20 years with the state and could have retired prior to May 1st, 2014. Prior to Scott's passing, he stood in his house in a personal conversation and told me he is choosing to put the extra 5 years in so he could retire with full medical benefits for his family. Scott prided himself on taking care of his family, being the sole wage earner so Brandy could stay home and raise their three girls. This was very important to him and Brandy. If Scott had not died in the line of duty on May 1st, 2014, he would have already retired and his family would have full medical benefits. To fund Senate Bill 48 is the right thing to do for the family of slain officers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next, we're going to go to Washington, D.C., with Kathy Wasserman with the Alaska Municipal League. Ms. Wasserman, are you online?
Yes, Senator. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I'm not there. I'm on business in Washington, D.C. I also have not read the
Can
latest...
Can you please state your name for the record?
I'm sorry. Kathy Wasserman, Executive Director of Alaska Municipal League in Juneau.
Thank you. You can begin.
I'm sorry that I have not read the newer version that's online right now, and I will do so. First of all, Senator Coghill, we want to thank you for this bill. It has some great points, but we do appreciate the fact that it is not an unfunded mandate at this point. Many municipalities, especially with the fiscal uncertainty of knowing how much they will of revenues they might get from the state for help in revenue sharing or in PERS funding, many of these municipalities are behind in their workers' comp bills, and if we saddle them then with new bills, they simply won't get paid, whether it's, even if it's a good bill like this might be. So I have checked anecdotally. I don't have all the exact numbers, but it seems like every municipality that has had a terrible tragedy in it that has happened with local police or fire have stepped up to the plate, and I think every municipality would continue to do that. I think it makes a strong fabric of a community to see them be able to do that. And but we do appreciate the fact that it is not an unfunded mandate, because at this time there will be communities that will just not be able to provide for these widows and orphans when the time is needed, if it's a complete requirement. They'll do what they can and as they can. So thank you for the time.
Thank you very much. Next, we're going to go to the committee room in Juneau. Susan Hex with Southern Region EMS, if you could come forward, please. State your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Susan Hex. I am the executive director of Southern Region EMS Council, based in Anchorage. The state of Alaska is divided into seven EMS regions, and Southern Region is one of the seven. I'm here representing the seven regions today. We've been meeting this week here in Juneau with all of the seven regions. The Alaska regional coordinators and directors are all here and in support of this bill and in support of my testimony. In your definitions, you have firefighter, and I like that you have changed the language to primary duty is to perform fire suppression, but there is one aspect missing from this bill, and that is emergency medical services. While many people think that if you say firefighter, you're also combining emergency medical services personnel into that, and that is not the case throughout Alaska. There are many EMS personnel who are not firefighters. In many departments who are hired, they are required to be cross-trained in fire-based EMS services, but they may not be certified as a firefighter for up to a year. Many, I know the North Slope Borough, they say that within a year they have to become a certified firefighter. So there's many EMS personnel throughout the state who are not firefighters initially, or who are not firefighters. That's not their intent when they're hired by the agency. EMS can be a very dangerous business as well, because you don't know what you're going to be dispatched to. You are dispatched alone. You go into a home. I know I've experienced this myself, where we end up all of a sudden in a behavioral emergency, or we end up in a domestic violence situation. I've had my life threatened. I've had guns present, not knowing what we're walking into. And I think the situation that really makes me think about this is on a highway incident, when you have EMS and fire both responding to a highway incident. And let's say, for example, there's something on the highway where you may have the situation, you think you're safe, but someone crashes into that scene. And let's say Mary, who's a firefighter, and John, who's EMT or a paramedic, they're both killed in that incident. And then the firefighter's family is eligible for benefits. The EMS personnel is not eligible for benefits. So I'd like you to consider adding emergency medical services into this bill, if at all possible. Thank you.
Thank you. We also have in the room, just for questions, Michelle Machado with a Division of Retirement Benefits, as well as Dan Wayne, Legislative Legal, also here. Are there any questions for members of the committee for Mr. Wayne or Ms. Machado at this point? Seeing none. Again, the CS has just been adopted. We've just opened public testimony. We're going to keep public testimony open. We'll put the bill off to the side for folks to read the bill, be able to contact the Senator Coghill's office, and we will pick this bill up in the very near future at one of our next meetings. Any closing comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.